case, let me review our procedures briefly. We have 15 minutes for each side for oral argument. The judges have read the briefs, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record. In light of that, you may wish to focus your argument on the legal issues rather than the facts, but how you present your argument is, of course, up to you. We have a digital timer, so you can determine for yourself how much time is left, especially if you're the appellant and you want to reserve time for your reply or rebuttal argument. We also have a colored lighting system. The lights are green when we start, amber when there are 5 minutes left, and red when your time is up. So you might use that for guidance also. There's a toggle switch on the podium that you can use to raise or lower it to suit your convenience. You should be aware also that we're recording the oral arguments and they'll be posted on the internet. So if there's any confidential or private information, you may want to be careful as to how you address that or refer to that during your arguments. I also am pleased to say that we're joined this afternoon by former Supreme Court Chief Justice Rovira for both of these arguments. So without further ado, let's begin with the first oral argument.
Your Honors, my name is Samuel Yan. My Colorado attorney license number is 28902. I represent the plaintiffs in Aiken v. Harris, which is 08CV76. And one of the plaintiffs is present in the room, Ms. Carol Steep Aiken. There are several parts in the complaint regarding venue, as well as the dismissal in the case, as well as some of the procedural issues in the delays in processing the case and the prejudices which arose as a result of that. I will confine my discussion to the issue of the dismissal. I will also touch very briefly on the underlying condemnation case on which this case is predicated, naturally. But Mr. Eismeyer will focus on the merits, including the merits of the fraud, as I touch mainly on the manner in which the dismissal occurred under CRCP 12b-5. I will note, however, that upon filing the First Amendment complaint and serving it on the defendants in early December 2007, which was after the opinion was rendered in the 05CA-1228 appeal of the underlying condemnation case, a voluntary disclosure by a new law firm representing the Harrises and Twin Spruce was made, which we refer to continually throughout the pleadings as the 12-2007 disclosures or the December 20th, 2007 disclosures. And these contain several essential facts, which essentially stated that as opposed to allegations during the pendency of the condemnation case, there was in fact a homeowners association that was self-formed, calling itself Twin Spruce Property Owners Association, a nonprofit Colorado association, which was never disclosed. Mr. Harris, one of the defendants in the present case, was the acting director president of that association. That association, which had not been formed under the Kiowa statute for homeowners or subdivision associations.
Let me interject one question right at that moment, because that's an important element of this case. Didn't Mr. Aiken or Ms. Aiken and her plaintiff stipulate or agree to Twin Spruce's substitution for the Harrises and the other Butler subdivision landowners as a respondent?
A stipulation occurred on November 1st, 2004, with a stipulation between the Aikens and the Harrises, and the attorney representing the Harrises occurred on 11-1-04. That stipulation stated that the Butler Subdivision Homeowners Association would be removed from the syllabus, and Twin Spruce Property Owners Incorporated would replace it as the respondent in the syllabus, and all of the elements of the complaint, I mean of the petition, would be alleged against Twin Spruce Property Owners Incorporated. It was not disputed that Twin Spruce Property Owners Incorporated was the owner, and it still is not disputed that the corporation is the owner. What is disputed was that it was not revealed at the time of that so-called waiver that Twin Spruce Property Owners Incorporated did not have a board of directors, had been reinstated by the...
Well, wasn't that an issue that could have been raised in AGA number one?
Indeed, it was raised, and indeed it was included in the opinion.
And, yes, and was that resolved then?
It was resolved to the extent that knowledge of the facts was disclosed to the petitioners in that case. And Mr. Eismeyer, who is representing the petitioners, appellants, and cross-appellees in the companion oral argument, is going to delve into the issues of waiver arising from that stipulation far more in depth. I'm focusing on the present case, and I'm merely outlining what the elements of the 12/20/2007 disclosures were. The disclosures stated that the defendants were aware at the time that the board of directors was deceased and or missing. Therefore, they were undertaking to reinstate, which would have been material at the time. If it could have been known, it would have had an effect on the attorney fees, on the attorney fee award, as well as the determination of ownership. The other defendants...
Mr. Yon, I'm going to interrupt there. You say it would have been material to the attorney fees, but yet your complaint sought over $1 million in damages. And as I read it, the relief you were really requesting was the value of the pipeline you would have obtained had you been successful in the underlying case.
Well, at this stage, we have lost so much time that there is a genuine issue of material fact that is unknown right now, whether or not the hole in the ground is still viable, whether the casing is still viable. We're not sure. And it has been so many years, because there was also litigation prior to this over that well site, that we may not be able to re-enter that well.
But let's say you're right that for some reason Twin Spruce wasn't properly reinstated. Twin Spruce was one of several defendants.
Correct.
Twin Spruce would have remained as a defendant. You didn't lose the case because of who the defendants were. You lost the case because of what you were claiming, and the court found that you did not seek a pipeline for a lawful purpose. It was the purpose. And that doesn't, who the defendants were just doesn't matter, does it? How are you harmed?
Your Honor, we sought to amend when we received the motion to dismiss. Two other defendants or respondents had filed motions to dismiss. Four Corners and Dolores Bridge Club had, and they had agreed, without informing us why, they agreed to drop their motion to dismiss.
Without prejudice.
Without prejudice and without attorney's fees on September
24th, 2004. So, without prejudice.
Filed also, they all filed identical motions challenging standing to petition for a pipeline easement. Cordy Wallace's was tossed out. It was ultimately dismissed. So the only extant motion to dismiss was Twin Spruce's. While it was pending, the petitioners conferred with the Twin Spruce representatives and sought to amend the petition to permit a pipeline company, which they had formed, to be substituted. And this was just weeks.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
You're not answering Judge Jones's question, which I think is pertinent. That is, what difference does it make whether Twin Spruce was in or out, was properly identified, was reinstated properly? The issue isn't the issue in this case, which you or your predecessor counsel initiated, the fact that you wanted to have a pipeline across these properties and you were seeking to condemn it for that purpose?
Well, that wasn't the basis for the dismissal.
Oh, I mean, wait a minute, wait, but isn't that the, am I correct in that assumption or not?
That we wanted to have a pipeline. You mean the basis for the present complaint?
Yeah.
No, we were not attempting to condemn for a pipeline through a complaint for money damages. That wasn't the point of this complaint.
Oh, you, what was the point of it?
Well, there was, first of all, there was...
Set aside the...
Once, it was a clear breach of a stipulation when Mr. Harris...
Can I ask a question or do you want to interrupt me?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you. In the basic question which Judge Jones was referring to, it doesn't matter who the defendants were in this case. Now, that's number one. Number two, whether it's Blue Spruce was properly... or Twin Spruce, whatever they call it, was properly...
Well, if we were going to discuss the condemnation case, it does make a difference because the petition asked the court to determine proper ownership. The court allowed Twin Spruce Property Owners, Inc. to enter the case as the property owner, as an intervener.
You stipulated and agreed to it.
But they are legally barred strictly because the board of directors had deceased.
Yes,
therefore, there was no prejudice at any time to the persons claiming to represent Twin Spruce Property Owners Incorporated. Tens of thousands of dollars of attorney fees was allocated to compensate for them for their prejudice, even though they withheld material facts going to the prejudice that they claimed they sustained. That is what the complaint is about. The damages caused by that prejudice under 38.1.122, the time lost, the lost opportunity to amend because of the prejudice to those claimed respondents when there was no other extant motion to dismiss.
Mr.
We've covered the motion, we've covered the condemnation case, and I would like to have 1 minute to talk about the present case.
Mr. Yon, I still have my pending question.
Okay.
I don't think you've answered it. Now, you say you wanted to substitute. I take it that was the GADECO substitution, that somehow you were prejudiced because you weren't able to substitute GADECO as a plaintiff.
GADECO, correct.
Okay. But under Aiken 1, GADECO would have lost, too. It wasn't the fact of who the plaintiff was or even who the defendant was. It was the purpose of the condemnation that was unlawful, regardless of who sought it. So how were you prejudiced?
My understanding of Aiken 1 was that only a pipeline company formed under Title VII may condemn. A pipeline company formed under Title VII was formed for the purpose of filing for the pipeline easement.
What prevented GADECO from substituting years earlier? What prevented that from being formed and substituted years earlier? It certainly wasn't anything the defendants did.
The law was ambiguous. The law at that stage, in 2004, was not clear as to who might condemn for a pipeline easement because it is a purely private takings. It is private four-inch gathering line for the use of the private property owner only. It was, and because there is no history of the legislative debates, it was ambiguous, and it certainly wasn't out of the ballpark for the petitioners to assume that they might petition under the private takings clause of the state constitution for the purposes of developing the state natural resources in a purely private takings case.
But it wasn't anything the defendants did that caused GADECO to want to be substituted. It was the fact that you got an opinion where you lost. You said, oh, we've got to have a pipeline company. Let's form one and let's bring a separate case.
I think one of the underlying fallacies in this case throughout has been that the defendants, namely Twin Spruce and the homeowners, had any property rights. They filed an affidavit in September 1, 2004, stating that only the incorporated entity had the property rights. The homeowners did not have property rights.
So what?
They disavowed property
rights. How did that prevent you from forming GADECO earlier? How did that affect your motion to substitute?
Well, let me ask, why did...
No, why don't you answer my question? Because that's the issue here. That's the crux. Your harm? What's your prejudice?
There was none, because the motion to...
To you, to your clients.
The motion to dismiss was filed on November 19th. We immediately started forming a pipeline company. And we approached the defendants in January of 2005, just 2 months later, to ask them if they would allow us to substitute. They claimed no because there was attorney fees, which they claim were owing back to the spring of 2004. Prior to July 1st of 2004, Twin Spruce could never have been reinstated because there was a two-year limitation on that, and the dissolution had occurred in 1982. So only after July 1st could Twin Spruce have been reinstated anyway.
Mr. Yon, excuse me, you have a little over a minute left. Did you wish to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Oh.
I recognize this podium. Members of the panel.
What's your name?
My name is Alan Hale.
Thank you, Mr. Hale.
And my
why don't you answer Judge Jones's question from your standpoint?
I will, Your Honor. Let me
now.
My registration number 14885. Let me answer your question, please, Judge Jones. The answer is it didn't make any difference at all. The fact is that the underlying action was a condemnation action, which was brought both under the Colorado Constitution and also 38.1.101, and it was brought as to condemn a private way of necessity. The reason there were all kinds of reasons why it was brought as a private to condemn a private way of necessity and not under a pipeline company statute. There's been statutes in Colorado for decades that give a special condemnation rights to pipeline companies for precisely the purpose that was sought here, which is to connect oil and gas production to pipelines. That's immaterial. The fact is that the district court in the what I would call as the Aiken 1 case found that there was no condemnation authority and dismissed that case. That case then came up to a division of this court, this court in its decision affirmed the lower court's dismissal. This action is related to that. The fact is, and I think that to go into more depth to answer Judge Jones's question, is really to take a look at the two critical orders that were entered by the court below in this case. The first of those orders was the order on dismissal. The second order was the order on reconsideration. And I would submit what the court did below was a very thorough, very detailed approach to analyzing the first amended complaint. That first amended complaint contained I think, as the court is probably familiar, it was 39 pages and 266 paragraphs, and contained, or to which is attached, six different documents, everything from articles of reinstatement, as well as orders in the, what I would call, Aiken 1 case. The court below properly considered that complaint and its attachments. And I believe the court basically concluded that simply by virtue of that pleading alone with its attachments, it was sufficient to support its order of dismissal. However, the court, I believe, went further. The court also then considered the motion to dismiss that had been filed and joined in by different parties. That motion to dismiss was actually filed by some parties under Rule 12b-1, The court determined that it would be more appropriate to analyze it under 12b-5 and proceeded to do so. And I think that the reason, frankly, that the court did that is, number one, it had the effect from a burden of proof standpoint in giving the plaintiffs the benefit of the doubt. As the court pointed out in its motion to reconsider, that by analyzing the first amended complaint under Rule 12b-5 instead of 12b-1, that the burden then was actually placed on the defendants, because the allegations in the complaint had to be taken as true, and all appropriate inferences had to go in favor of the plaintiffs. Had it been analyzed under 12b-1, the plaintiffs would have had to come in and assert jurisdiction.
Mr. Hale, Judge Hanson also said this wasn't a 12b-1 wasn't a proper vehicle for subject matter jurisdiction on the issues that were being raised. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And I'd like to tell you that at the time we prepared and filed the 12b-1 motion, we had real good reasons for doing that, but it's been quite a while. At any rate, I think my point here is that the court below, the reasoning of the court below, was both detailed and deliberate. And I think,
Mr. Hale, I'm going to interrupt you a little bit because I want to get to these documents that were disclosed in December of 2008.
Yes.
I think that was the date. I understand those documents were not disclosed in Aiken 1. My understanding of the record is that the plaintiffs had sought some discovery as to the reinstatement of Twin Spruce. Twin Spruce had opposed that, and the court had disallowed that discovery. The court had allowed discovery on the issue of the corporation's good standing, as I recall, but not the manner in which it was reinstated. Is that consistent with your recollection?
I think that's essentially correct. And I think if we, the fact is that I believe that discovery was not sought. I'd have to review the timeline really quickly, but I'm fairly comfortable making this representation, Judge Jones, that discovery was not sought until after the court had entered its order in Aiken 1.
So it was sought in the context of the attorney fees motions or that, motions to reconsider. Was that the context?
In the context of the attorney's fee motion.
We're talking about that, Mr. Hale, would a statement such as the following be appropriate? The district court granted the request for documentation establishing that Twin Spruce owned property issue, but refused to allow discovery to whether Twin Spruce was fraudulently reinstated. And Aiken and the appellants did not appeal that order in Aiken 1, nor did they contend in Aiken 1 that Twin Spruce had failed to comply with the discovery order. So is that correct, or is that the correct statement?
That is correct, Justice Rivera. That is correct.
And they have the opportunity to discuss this in Aiken 1?
Yes.
They could have filed it in their brief?
Yes.
They did not.
And they did not.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hale, to follow up on Justice Rivera's question, did the plaintiffs know from the original documents of incorporation of Twin Spruce as to the identity of its directors when it was first formed?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to suggest that, and I can tell you personally, since I was there, absolutely no knowledge. But I will say, and I tell the court this is not an uncommon occurrence in condemnation practice. Under Section 38.1.102, which is the basic condemnation section and provision that describes what a condemnor needs to put in its petition, it says that you need to know who the property owners are or others who have an interest, potential interest in property. In other words, it doesn't confine it to property owners. And oftentimes, the state of title, particularly in western Colorado counties where I grew up, and particularly sometimes in some of the more remote areas, title isn't as easy as going to a title insurance company and finding out who owns what. And so condemnation actions start with the best available information. And then as they proceed, parties are often added or dropped based on stipulations. Here, all of this happened right away. In other words, before there was any disclosure, before there was any discovery, the motion to dismiss was filed.
Mr. Hale, at what point did the plaintiffs learn that Twin Spruce had been administratively dissolved in 1982?
To my knowledge, I believe that the plaintiffs, your question was, at what point did the plaintiffs learn that?
Yes.
Well,
I understand you don't represent the plaintiffs.
I don't represent the plaintiffs. However, I think that the most correct answer that I could give you, if the shoe was on the other foot, is the fact of being administratively dissolved was a fact of public record. By checking the Secretary of State's records, which you normally would do in the preparation of a complaint and the naming of the proper parties, you would determine whether an association or a corporation is in good standing. And if that if it looks like they were administratively dissolved, that would appear of public record. And so I would say, whether they knew it or not, I think all parties are probably charged with that knowledge.
But they didn't even sue Twin Spruce at the beginning. They sued the Butler Subdivision Homeowners Association.
That's correct. And I think that's what led to the stipulation of substitution.
That's a follow. Let me follow that up with the first question I asked counsel for the appellant. Aiken and Stepp, the appellants here, agreed to Twin Spruce's substitution. Did they agree to the substitution for the Harrises and the other Butler Subdivision landowners as defendants in this case? Stipulate or agree to that?
I believe that there was a stipulation, and I can't, I have to tell you, Justice Rivera, without looking at the document, I can't tell you whether all parties signed it. I do know that if the other defendants didn't sign it, they were
more aware. Important to me is, did Aiken and Stepp agree to Swin Spruce's substitution for the Harrises and other Butler Subdivision owners? Did they agree?
Most definitely, yes.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Hale, you started to touch on this issue of corporate law. That is, who has the rights and who has the interests such that a person can try to reinstate a corporation like this? I've looked at the version of the statute that was in effect in 1976, which I don't think anybody cited. The definition of a member there is a little bit different than the definition of a member currently. And I don't know if you have it, but it says a member means one having membership rights in a corporation in accordance with the provision of its articles of incorporation or bylaws. Does that mean that the person claiming an interest has to be someone named in the articles of incorporation or bylaws? I think that's the position of the appellants here.
Yeah, I do think that is a potentially, the issue is not as clear as it could be. And I think that the court below recognized that in part in its motion to dismiss, and I want to particularly point the court to page 7, footnote 2, and this would be volume 1, page 988, where the court below said brought up the issue of standing to challenge the internal affairs. And although this wasn't the same point, Judge Jones, I do think that in part is what the court was getting at. But again, I think that the answer is, whatever confusion there might be or whatever uncertainty might exist, that all of the identification of every single homeowner or person who owns an interest in land, which comprises Twin Spruce, is available of public record.
But isn't it possible that you have a subdivision like we have here, where you have individual landowners, to be sure, but there are common areas and there are rights of way and streets and things like that that are not owned by the homeowners, that are owned by some other entity, maybe Twin Spruce.
Well, that is exactly, I wouldn't say it's exactly the case here, but it's very much how the property is organized in this particular area. And let me give you an example. And I think this was raised in Aiken One. I have two clients, although I'm speaking today on behalf of all the defendants in this case. I started out with two clients. One is called Dolores River Bridge Club, and the other one is Four Corners Encampment. And I sometimes get funny looks when I say Dolores River Bridge Club, because no, they don't play cards and get together. But literally what they are is they couldn't figure out how to get a bridge across the Dolores River. And this is upstream from the town of Dolores, so upstream from McPhee Reservoir. Canyon narrows a little bit. There are homeowners on both sides, and the river kind of does one of those, you know, crosses from one side to the other, so they couldn't figure out what to do. And there were homeowners who didn't want to pay for a bridge. There were some homeowners who did. So they literally formed the Dolores River Bridge Club. And they went out and found an old boxcar.
All right, I think I see the point.
And that's the only piece of property that Dolores River Bridge Club owns.
All right, but you see where this is going. See, the contention of the appellee seems to be that, in essence, the landowners, the homeowners, are the owners of the property that was subject to the condemnation potentially. I'm questioning that. I mean, it doesn't follow necessarily to me. I mean, there are rights of way that the pipeline wanted to go across. I guess I'm not clear that there's a record that those rights of way were conveyed to the homeowners. That is, they could have been retained by the original developers of the property. So that those original developers, essentially those three people named in the Articles of Incorporation, owned it. So what gives a homeowner who doesn't have an ownership interest, perhaps, we don't know, the right to come in and reinstate this dissolved corporation that may own the property?
I would say two things. Let's deal directly and just specifically with your question. If it's not clear that there's statutory authority, I would suggest that there's equitable authority. Somebody has to stand up and be responsible for those pieces of property or those property interests that are not owned or controlled by others. And at some point, if no one will stand up, then there are sort of default provisions in the statute, which would say, okay, well, here's what you do. But the fact is that whether Twin Spruce was properly reinstated, whether there was fraud involved as its reinstatement, as plaintiffs allege, Twin Spruce was, and its status was not a key part to why the Aiken One case was dismissed. And here's why. There's nothing today that would prevent, and I apologize, I'm out of time. I've run over my time, and I will be happy to answer questions the court has. But.
Okay, well, I think your time has expired, so we appreciate your argument, Mr. Hill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Yon, since we let Mr. Hill have a couple of extra minutes, we will accord you the same if you need a couple of extra minutes.
Thank you. I would just like to make three brief comments. First, on July 18, 2005, petitioners filed a suggestion of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The petitioners in the condemnation case filed a suggestion of lack of subject matter jurisdiction on July 18, 2005, the eve of the final allocation of attorney fees, arguing that insufficient evidence had been provided in the discovery, which was specifically requested in their objection to Mr. Harris's reappearance in the case in the attorney fee statements.
But you didn't appeal that. But you didn't appeal that, did you?
Yes, in the page 19 of the opinion, of the April 2007 opinion, page 19, attorney fees petitioners challenged the district court's award of attorney fees to respondents. specifically contend that Twin Spruce was not entitled to an award of attorney fees because it was not properly revived as a corporation. It was extensively discussed in the briefing.
I want to distinguish between, though, the discovery.
The discovery was
this whole discovery issue
in this court when the petitioners challenged Mr. McLaughlin's credentials to enter an appearance on behalf of Twin Spruce, to which Mr. McLaughlin responded by providing the same responses he provided to the May 12, 2005 discovery order, which was the old articles of incorporation, the new certificate of good standing, which anyone can obtain off the Secretary of State site, the revival of Twin Spruce filed by Mr. Harris as the registered agent without disclosing his role as acting president and director of the Homeowners Association. Now, one other thing I'd like to state, and that is that much of what has been discussed in the context of 08CV76, the COCA / breach of contract complaint, has been discussed, I believe, in the context of Rule 56. This was a 12B5 dismissal, which extended the boundary of the O'Neill v. Simpson case, which merely gives a court the right to take judicial notice of a prior proceeding, a prior case, merely to see if there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate an issue. Ipso facto, the nature of the 12-2007 disclosures make it very clear that it was impossible to have a full and complete airing of the issues pertaining to those disclosures, the reinstatement, the reappearance of Mr. Harris as the reimbursee, and matters concerning reinstatement, and issues touching on fraud. It was impossible to litigate that in the previous proceeding. O'Neill does not give the court leave to go any further than to merely scan the case to see if there was if the elements of collateral estoppel are satisfied. If they are not satisfied, there is no collateral attack. Any further penetration of the fraud is venturing onto Rule 56 territory. The judge, by denying the case, by dismissing the case on the grounds that the fraud was immaterial, on the basis of the fact that there were attorney, that there was, that the attorney was
zealously
representing property interests.
Why is it material that Twin Spruce be a defendant or not a defendant?
That's the point. That's
why, explain to me, my sense of this case, although I may be mistaken, is that it doesn't make any difference who the defendant, whether Twin Spruce is in or out. Rather, does the plaintiff, do the plaintiffs have the right to condemn that property, whatever that property might be, for the purposes of a pipeline?
There was the legal holding which related to the petitioner's standing to condemn. Granted, the complaint makes several statements. In the body of the complaint states it is not attempting to overturn that result. That result is not under attack.
You're trying to, but aren't you trying to overturn that result by going the fraud route?
The petitioners were assessed for attorney fees which were not assessed on behalf of the property owner. The property owner was the corporation. The property owner was the corporation, and when the court...
So what you're really arguing about today is it the attorney's fees or the whole question of the condemnation?
There was also...
What is your argument
there
today?
There was also a breach of contract when Mr. Harris reappeared, which gave the petitioner standing to challenge the reinstatement, because there was a promise. There was an exchange of promises. Justifiable reliance, and there was forbearance and actions which were promised. The action which was promised was that Mr. Harris would remove himself from the case. He came back into the case without disclosing that his role was acting president and director of the association, which had not been disclosed to the court, which was the core of the unlawful reinstatement, which led to the attorney fees being assessed. So there was breach of contract, which is not, in my understanding, not subject to O'Neill scrutiny or 12B5 dismissal, or even collateral attack analysis. There was a straight breach of that stipulation when he reappeared.
Mr. Yaron, your time is up.
Thank you.
Even as extended. So thank you to both of you for your oral arguments this afternoon. We do appreciate them. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.